Hello, and welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharicana. We invite you to join us on Thursdays at 8 p.m. for an engaging exchange with us and our special guest as we cover various topics regarding history, genealogy, and your personal family history stories. Hello, I'm Janice Gilliard.
And I'm Sharicana Feliciano. Welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharicana. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Today, we are joined by our guest, Tansy Ward.
Tansy Ward is dedicated to historic preservation and education. She is a passionate antique dealer, author, historian, and antiquarian. She began her journey as a business owner specializing in the preservation of antique heirlooms at Zenathia Jewelry. Her keen interest in antiques has contributed to her extensive knowledge in the decorative arts field, which includes writing content on various historical events and trends that have influenced the industry. A graduate of the Ashford Institute of Antiques, Tansy earned her certification in antiques, collectibles, and appraising. She is a proud member of the Ashford Associate Membership Program and the American Society of Jewelry Historians. Her fascination for antiques and history has enhanced her insight and expertise on historical collectibles. She seeks to educate and share her passion for history and antiques with others. Welcome, Tansy Ward, to Speak On It.
Hi, thank you so much. It is an honor to be a part of this podcast, and thank you guys for having me on.
You are welcome. So we're going to go ahead and get started. And Tansy, you're in a unique and fascinating line of work. Can you tell us how you got started in antiques and jewelry? And then I'm curious to know, does your family play a role in any of this?
Definitely. So I've always been considered like an old soul, really interested in like antiques and whatnot. I started watching Antique Roadshow with my grandma when I was little, and that was the first kind of start of me being interested in antiques. And then for my 24th birthday in 2017, I decided that I wanted to like gift myself something, and I decided to like start my business with antiques. And at first I was just specializing in like costume jewelry from the mid-century era, such as like beautiful rhinestone jewelry and whatnot. But I realized over time that that wasn't really like my specialty. A lot of times when you first start as an antique dealer, or even as another business, you really realize, maybe I should go to something that's like another specialty. And then that's when I really started to really be interested in incorporating Victorian photos of African Americans with Victorian jewelry. I would go on a lot of Instagram pages, and I would not see a lot of like Victorian Black people dressed very dapper and very distinguished. It was mostly just pages dedicated to mostly like white Victorians and maybe like one or two, you know, Black Victorians on the page. And even though like I've always been fascinated with eras like that, and I said, why not, you know, start selling nothing but antique jewelry, which is antique is at least 100 years old. And then I wanted to kind of incorporate Black Victorian photos with that to show people that, you know, the elegant, distinguished side of Black people during the 19th century. Because a lot of times when we see photos from the 19th century, it's like negative or like it shows like disparity among Black people. But there was a lot of like beautifully dressed Black Victorians wearing beautiful jewelry. So I was like, I can not only decide to specialize in antique jewelry from the Victorian era and early 20th century, but then I also start to show it like Black people wearing jewelry like that as well, you know, back in the day, and kind of connect those two together. And then I started to just also collect, you know, antique portraits and antique photographic jewelry, especially of Black Victorians.
So before we get into the next question, Tansy, can you kind of like expound to, and how did you make that transition into saying like, you know, I want to do this as a business? Like, what was that moment, I guess, for you where, you know, you're like, you know, I think I really want to do this? Because so many folks, you know, a lot of us have interests and hobbies and things like that, but often have difficulty, you know, or feel like we can't, you know, transition into like an actual business. So can you maybe just share some insight into that?
Definitely. So I realized that I've always loved antiques and vintage. especially like vintage and antique jewelry and clothes. And so I was like, I collect all these antiques, and especially like antique jewelry and whatnot. So why not create a business, you know? And because that's something that I'm passionate about, and I'm just a huge fan of like vintage fashion, you know, antiques. And so since I'm very passionate about it, I figured, you know, why not do it? And the more you're passionate about something, the more you actually, you know, it's like a hobby that you really enjoy doing. So like I say, like 4 years later after I started, I was like, why not also persuade and further my education, you know, when it comes to that? So then I went into the Asheville Institute of Antiques, and then I studied antique appraising, which is something that, you know, like I'm very thankful that I did that, and you know, decided to become like an antique appraiser. And you know, after going to school and learning more of that, it's like I feel like it just comes hand in hand naturally. You know, you're like, if you're passionate about something, you want to learn more about it. But you know, starting the business, like I just was like, one day I was like, for my 24th birthday, why not do that? Because I already like have like a whole bunch of like collectibles. You know, it's a hobby. So why not?
That's amazing. That's awesome. I'm also curious too about the name that you came up with for your business. So Zenathia. What can you tell us about that?
Definitely. So that name actually came a long time ago when I was like 11, 12 years old. I've been a writer for a while, even before I published my books. And I've always knew I wanted to use that for something. Like at first I was like, maybe I should write like a fantasy novel called The Chronicles of Zenathia. Like literally when I was 12, I thought of that. And then it kind of sat in my head for a while. And then I was like, finally, I was like, that's what I'll name the business. But yeah, I've had that name in my head for a long time. And actually, a couple of years back, I actually met someone named Zenathia, which I thought was like, wow, it was so interesting. But
That is so cool.
yeah, I know, where I was like, I've never met someone by name Zenathia, but you know, it just was like a name that was stuck in my head since I was like 11, 12. And I had like re I used it to write like short fantasy stories. I thought I was gonna be like the next like J.K. Rowling or something, but like literally, I was like, hey, that's the name that was like the original like to me, and that I had like thought about when I was 11, 12. So then I was like, why not?
See, just a Renaissance woman. I love it. So creative. And it was, you made me think of, I don't know if you've seen Lovecraft Country, but I can't think of her character that she wrote, but one of the little girl in the show, she was a comic and she wrote, different comic strips and, you know, really, really cool stories. And the character she wrote reminds me of the name Zenathia, but I can't think of it now, but it begins with a Z. But, it's really awesome to see, you know, women in particular, like just doing these multifaceted things. And, you know, a lot of times as creatives, you know, you have different things that are interesting to you. And it can be like, you know, it's a nice way to, it's nice to see people blend their interests and make it all just kind of flow for them. So that's really, really cool. Thank you for sharing that. So, Andy, what are a few of your favorite stories or interesting things you've learned in your line of work?
Definitely. So the things that I've learned, like I think that being passionate about it, I've always liked to like dive into research and like archives. And so what I'm finding is that number one, when it comes to like Black history and seeing like Black Victorians and in a very distinguished light, it's not just something that other Black people like we want to see, but I have a lot of people that DM me that are interested in that too, because it's information that they did not receive. Like and the Hidden Legacies book, I mentioned how Lucky Street was named after Solomon Lucky. And a lot of people was very intrigued by that. They didn't realize that was a Black man. He was a free Black man who was emancipated and free before the actual Emancipation Proclamation. And so it was like, even before slaves were emancipated, he was a free man, a barber who worked downtown Atlanta, and he was struck by a bullet. And the bullet had hit a lamppost he was standing by, and also eventually killed him. And that lamppost was in underground Atlanta for years. The name was named Lucky Street, but we did not learn that, you know, in our Georgia history class. You know, when it comes to that, a lot of people, you know, contact me and people from all walks of life who were very interested in that, because they were like, we didn't learn this. Or even when I was talking about Black aristocrats in Europe, you know, people did not learn that in school, you know, certain things. A lot of people didn't learn a lot of information that is very important, especially in K through 12, because when, you know, we get to college, you know, they have different departments and different studies and programs that, you know, may talk about that more, you know, especially if you go like an HBCU or even, you know, and a non-HBCU, there are different, you know, classes you can take and courses that will mention, you know, Moores or whatnot. But when it comes to K through 12, mm-hmm. That's not learned. Like it baffled me kind of. I was like, this is like Georgia. We didn't learn who Solomon Lucky was. And so that's one thing that really stuck out to me, that people like, you know, they are interested in that period, you know, no matter, you know, what, you know, ethnicity they are, because it's just very interesting. It's history that people are very intrigued by, because they're not used to seeing those type of images that, you know, are kind of, you know, a lot of times when we think about Black history and a lot of the positive aspects, like when we talk about like Harlem Renaissance, but when we talk mm-hmm. about Victorian era, which is 1837 to 1901, Black Victorians and like, you know, affluent Black Victorians and people who are dressed very, you know, beautifully and dapper and distinguished, that's not emphasized or, you know. Mm-hmm. The second thing I learned too was I've been focusing more on Black Americana. And then, because my first book was about like the like African presence in European antiques. But what I'm learning mm-hmm. now is that it's a lot of positive Black Americana out there, but the yes. narrative of Black Americana is a very negative, you know, stereotypical, you know, images that definitely is distorted. So a lot of times when people think about Black Americana, a lot of things they think about is like the mammy jars and the, yep. the lips and like the cartoonish features. But right. Black Americana means basically like it's collectibles that emphasize the history of Black people in America. And so Black Americana, the kind that we see, the stereotypical negative images, that's incorrect. But the positive Black Americana, which is the true Black Americana that represents Black people, the history of Black people in America, are the distinguished portraits, you know, that they took, you know, in that era, you know, those beautiful yeah. portraits. And I really wanted to update that narrative. So that's one thing that I learned too, was that, you know, it's very important to emphasize that. So more people, when they think about Black Americana, they think about the real non-distorted images that's associated with Black people in America during the Victorian era. Because like I said, those negative cartoonish Black Americana images, that's not the real, you know, portrayals. That's not the real like Black American history. That's just a distorted image right. that was based off of racism. So I really learned to emphasize the updating the narrative of Black Americana, because all the portraits that I collect, that's Black Americana, but it's real Black Americana. It's the positive images, the very distinguished images that represent the like accurate portrayals of Black Americans. And then the third thing I learned too was definitely just always like make sure you continue. I realized to like focus on like what you're passionate about, and then people will like naturally kind of gravitate towards that. When I first changed like my specialty and posting like Black Victorian images and writing different like blog posts and stories, I didn't know like people were gonna like it at, like a whole bunch. I knew I liked it, but I was like kind of like, well, you never know. And then I realized that the more you're passionate about something and the more you like really care about it, the more, you know, you're gonna gravitate to people who like, they appreciate that, and they also have similar interests. Like I thought mm-hmm. that, especially like, you know, being a millennial Black antique dealer and, you know, historic preservation and whatnot, a lot of times I wasn't always running to people like personally like me mm-hmm. Because the antique industry can be, it's still like some problems when it comes to representation and race. And so I right. met, you know, people like me, especially like through like social media, who were like, oh, I'm into that too. So I realized, you know, just being passionate about it and continue to like focus on that, you know, you will connect with people that, you know, love the same things that you love. And, you know, other like millennial, like Black antique dealers or like Black young preservationists who are into the same things that I'm into, that are doing the same work that I'm doing.
There are three things that come to mind as you were speaking. And one is hidden history revealed in your work, correcting the historical narrative, the perception that's out there. I love the mission that you're on to go, no, excuse me, this is what it's about. So correcting the historical narrative. And then something I've been talking about lately, and that is being authentic in your space and what you're doing and being yourself. You don't have to try to be anybody else. Whatever you're really, really passionate about and you pursue that, I love what you said. People will be drawn to that. You know, you may think, oh, I'm the only one that's interested in this. But then when you get out and start talking about it and you find out that there are other people that are interested because you're sharing information or sharing things that they didn't know, it's like, wow. So that's what I get from what you've learned. And I really, really like that part where you're correcting the historical narrative, where folks are thinking that, like you said, Black Africana is one thing and it's something totally different, what you've learned. So I love that you're educating folks. Next, Tansy, we wanted to know, you said you wrote a book entitled Unsung Portraits, Anonymous Images of Black Victorians and Early 20th Century Ancestors. Why was writing this book important for you? And what can we learn from these images of Black Victorians?
Definitely. So when I published Hidden Legacies, African Presence in European Antiques, I was focused on like the positive portrayals of Black descendants in Europe, because I honestly at the time felt like all the like positive, you know, images I'm seeing in art and whatnot, a lot of times it is from like Europe, when you see like those European artists paint portraits of Moorish diplomats and aristocrats and all these beautiful images. But then I realized, you know, also like Black Americana extends way further than like the negative caricatures and stereotypes that, you know, we see. A lot of these caricatures that we see, you know, these cartoonish figures and whatnot, it definitely doesn't represent Black Americans during the 19th century. So I wanted to publish Unsung Portraits because I started collecting beautiful images of Black people during the 19th century, you know, cabinet cards and tintypes of people's ancestors, and also seeing some of my own, and they're looking very beautiful and dapper and distinguished. And then I also was reading a lot of W.E.B. Du Bois information and Frederick Douglass, and they also emphasize that. And I got inspired too, because Frederick Douglass, the reason why he was one of the most photographed men during the 19th century was because he wanted to emphasize that. He wanted to emphasize, you know, Black people being dignified and distinguished in those portraits. And there's actually historical context and sources that actually, you know, say that from him, you know, how it's important for us to like use that camera, use photography to, you know, kind of basically update that narrative and like show us in a true, accurate light. And then also, I realized too that, you know, it's so many other people that also is interested in that and have photos, you know, from that era that I always, like I say, like in historic preservation work, I always tell them like, preserve your family ancestral photos, that's important. Yeah. And so this book was just about, you know, showcasing positive Black Americana, non-distorted, you know, like those accurate images. I put myself in their shoes. They used the camera photography. It was kind of like a radical thing for them to do, because if you look at the portrayal in the media by Black people, by other people, it was very negative, very stereotypical and racist. And even W.E.B. Du Bois, there's a quote that I put in the book too, when he was like, why don't more Black people take up photography? And then he was describing how it was important for us to do that because we can't leave it up to other people to, you know, continue to, you know.
Exactly. Wait for them to,
yeah, exactly,
portray us in a different light. Just an interjection very quickly. Listening to you, I'm thinking to myself, she's right. In the history books, when I was growing up, every picture was everybody on a plantation.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't anything that was positive about us. And in my research, I found historical photos, and the people are dressed very nicely. Okay, granted, we know this slavery exists, but how come you don't show us in your books or publications? Why aren't we presented in other ways? Why? I think that's by design.
Yeah, no, definitely. Also, one thing that I wanted to emphasize too is that what inspired me in this book, because a lot of times when we see these images that belong, they are people's ancestors, you know, they're unsung because they are like a very distinguished, intricate part of American history. But a lot of times, you know, I said anonymous because a lot of times I don't have any information, any background on them, you know, just like right. the details in the photo. Because, you know, a lot of cabinet card photos and tintypes, especially like tintypes and whatnot, they don't have any information on it unless it's like it's the actual photography studio. And every now and then you may get an image where on the back, like a real photo postcard, where it may have like some information, but that's why I also was like, these are anonymous, but they are like very distinguished, intricate part of history. And then a lot of us, a lot of Black people have photos like this in their family. Like there are several Facebook pages where people post like their ancestors. And one thing I noticed is the Black people are dressed very nicely in the 19th century, beautiful fur stoles on. We were very dapper back then. Mm-hmm. We loved to dress up back then.
More so than the way we're represented.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And it was also done by that on purpose too, because if you look at the photos that Black people took of their families and whatnot, they were dressed really nicely. You know, they were showcasing themselves like, this is who we are. We're not that those cartoonish mammy jars and watermelon postcards, like this is who we are. And even like one chapter of my book is called Little Brown Angel Faces, because I thought that was so important too. And I have a like whole bunch of like photos of like beautiful dapper dressed children, you know, and they didn't even realize that what they were doing was so important and historical. And we're going to reflect back on that, you know, nearly 100 years ago. I mean, years later, you know what I'm saying? So I think right. that like, that's why I say preserve your family photos, because a lot of us, like, we have photos of like great grandmama and all them dressed really nice, you know, mm-hmm. like dapper, dressed to their nines. And that's important. That's important representation. And unfortunately, people did not see that, you know, in the books. But I just want to urge people to like understand the importance of that. Like, that is a true, accurate portrayal. Black people, you know, in the 19th century and 20th century, they dressed up, even if they were, it didn't matter what occupation they was, how much money they had. You know, a lot of us have ancestry photos at where, you know, our ancestors and relatives are looking really nice in these photos. Yes.
Especially on a Sunday, especially on the Sundays.
But not even just on a Sunday, like literally like someone could just be walking down the street or just like taking, mm-hmm. you know, like it was just like, and then I really love that. And especially like during the Victorian era, when I see like, you know, the Black men in the three-piece suits with the top hats and the women in the fur stoles, this was very popular. And it's like thousands, probably millions of photos out there like wow. that. But for some reason, growing up in education, you know, K through 12, they only wanted to show Black people as slaves, which was like, not the only story of that era. So that's what I wanted to like really emphasize with these photos.
Well, you know, not only is it only pictures of slavery, but then it's not even a full story about slavery. You know, you still get
free people of color.
Right.
Or free people of color. Yep.
Exactly. You're still not getting the full story. So they tell part of the story, and then it's still part of the story. So, you know, this is important work that you're doing for sure. And so talking about pictures and old pictures, this is a great segue to the next question. You know, something a lot of people want to do is when they have these old photos of family members, they want to know, like, what era was this? Like, you know, I've been in Facebook groups where people post a picture like, does anyone know around what year this was taken? So do you have any like just quick and easy tips and tricks people can use to help them date old photos?
Definitely. So I would recommend looking at the type of photo it is. That's a good giveaway. So tintypes and daguerreotypes, which was made during the invented in the mid 19th century. That is a good giveaway. So anything that's like a tintype or daguerreotype or amber type, definitely it was in the mid 19th century to like, I would say the end of the 19th century, but like around like tintypes and daguerreotypes became popular like 1850s, especially with tintypes and daguerreotypes. But I think that's a good giveaway too. Mm-hmm. And then like by the time the late 19th century came, like there was more like cabinet cards and whatnot. And then you had real photo postcards. A lot of people are very familiar with that. So real photo postcards, I don't know if you guys have seen them. You've probably seen them a lot of times, but on the back, it has like an actual postcard, you know, yeah. on there. So that was popular during the early 20th century. So you can also just date it by the photos. Of course, the clothes, definitely, like a lot of times when you look at the clothes, you kind of can tell too, like, you know, especially if you know the type of like historical costumes that were mm-hmm. out during that time, like the Victorian era clothes, and also like early 20th century styles, especially like you're looking at like the, you know, type of trends in the photo or like the fashion. And but definitely also that, also any information that's on the card, you know, sometimes it's like dates. Also, if it's a photography studio, you can look at that photography studio and look it up, and more than likely some type of historical information on it. But definitely, like I would say, the type of photo is most important. The type of photo is most important because two types and daguerreotypes kind of went out of style by the late 19th century. Okay. And they were replaced eventually by, especially during the early 20th century, real photo postcards. So mm-hmm. if you see something that is a real photo postcard, it's from like the early 20th century, not like 1860 or anything like that. So I think definitely knowing the type of photo and also just examining like the characteristics inside of the photo.
Got it. Thank you for that.
I'm sitting here thinking of Antiques Roadshow and I'm going Tansy's Antique Roadshow. If you decide to do that, just send me $5. But I'm sure it would do well. I'm sure it would do well. So if someone has a piece of antique jewelry or an item that they're not sure what to do with, what are some next steps that you would advise them to take?
Definitely. So I would say first, it's important to make sure that you preserve it properly. So one thing that I say is that if you don't know exactly how to preserve an antique, it's best to not compromise its original integrity. So go to someone who, you know, can definitely, like whether it's an antique appraiser or, you know, someone who specializes in preservation of antiques, you know, definitely don't like try to mess with it too much, or, you know, and definitely go to an appraiser. There are people out there who have amazing things in their house and don't even realize it, whether it's like old antique photos, you know, whatnot. And it depends on the antique, you know, when it comes to how to preserve it, but definitely like getting something appraised is important too. Like, especially if you have something that's like a family heirloom, like jewelry, you know, from like your great, you know, grandparents or whatnot, has some type of stone in it. Definitely, like if you don't know, and if you do research on your own and you're still, you know, kind of like hesitant or you want more information, don't be afraid to just contact, you know, antique appraiser or historic preservationist who specializes in that particular antique, because that's important. And then also it depends on the object. Like if it's a jewelry, you know, also I wrote an article a while back about make sure you preserve the jewelry properly. So not putting it like all in one jewelry box, especially if it's like older jewelry, you mm-hmm. know, it's antique. So make sure that you take time to do that. And also don't like put too many harsh chemicals on it. That applies to like, you know, jewelry and accessories. If it's a photo, definitely keep it away from UV lights. You want to keep it away from like a lot of moisture, keep it in acid-free sleeve coverings. So that's important. You know, photos, you know, antique photos, a lot of them were like created and processed way differently than, you know, now. So especially when it comes to like tintypes and whatnot. So you want to make sure that you keep it away from like moisture and like a lot of like dust and like sun, you know, because that can actually compromise it as well. Real photo postcards are not as sensitive as like a tintype from the 19th century, but definitely keeping them in acid-free sleeve coverings. And if you want to get something restored, I would definitely recommend contacting someone who specializes in that particular field. Like, for instance, you know, those convex glass portraits that may have like the wood frame or whatnot on it, or if it's a piece of like portrait that like the piece is falling apart, definitely I recommend going to someone like who specializes in that, instead of like trying to like always like do it yourself. You know, don't try to like stick it on with like regular glue and stuff like that. So definitely that's some advice I would give.
What if you have some, say, jewelry, and you know that it's valuable, antique jewelry, you know it's valuable, but you're not sure. Would you recommend going to more than one appraiser?
Definitely. I think it's great to go to more than one appraiser. I definitely recommend that. Just want to get like of course, not just like value estimates, but you also want to go to like more than one person to kind of see, especially if something that's like very valuable or you don't know more, you want to know more information on it. Usually when it comes to most antiques, like with antique jewelry, going to one appraiser, especially if they have like they're highly esteemed and respect, you know, in that field and they have a lot of history dealing with that, then that should be good. But then, you know, if you're dealing with certain things, whether it's like a Picasso painting or like an antique, you know, diamond or something, you definitely want to go to multiple antique appraisers, you know, definitely, and kind of compare, you know, mm-hmm. like what they say. But in general, most antique appraisers, you know, when it comes to like, especially those who really, you know, mastered their field and whatnot, they would have some of the same general information, but you still want to go to like more than one just to compare.
So why do you feel historic preservation is important, Tansy?
I think it's very important to not just like knowing about the history of the past, but just the future. It's so many people out there that unfortunately they don't care about certain things because they feel like they're not connected to it. Like we all heard the story about people who like sell off their great grandparents' stuff or don't care about, you know, mm-hmm. antiques. They just give it away. And it's just, it's so many intricate stories in there. And then also a lot of times things that happen in the future are connected to the past. Like it's people out there who, you know, are being taught, you know, educational courses in K-12 and they don't realize, you know, all this amazing history that, you know, it's not in the books. You have people out there who have these amazing portraits that their elders are holding on to. And when the elders dies, someone else has to preserve those photos. Mm-hmm. So it's important to care about stuff like that. Also community-based. I was a part of a historic preservation festival in Atlanta. And Atlanta is changing. I'm Atlanta native. And there are some people who, you know, don't understand the history and the importance of certain, you know, parts of the city. You know, like I was telling people about how like people call it West Midtown, but there's no such thing as a West Midtown. Mm. And you know, that area is a historically Black area named after a Black person, Blandtown. And a lot of people don't even realize that, you know. Now some people do, some older natives do and whatnot, and people who really care, but that's important. So historic preservation is very important, and you have like these intricate stories connected to these spaces and these objects that tell a story, and it's important to continue that legacy on instead of just letting things just like, you know, like be demolished, or you know, your family portraits like be discarded and end up on mm-hmm. eBay. You know, a lot of times when I'm collecting these portraits, I consider myself like a keeper of these ancestral portraits, because I'm pretty sure, you know, they're someone's loved ones. And a lot of these portraits, you know, people don't even realize that that's their great, great, great grandparent. You know, a lot of times when I'm telling people about my book, I'm like, that could be someone you're related to, you know, like you never know. That's why it's so important for us to care about those things. And then also the case with Harvard, with the family fighting to get their you don't want to be like that, like your family kind of, you know what I'm saying, being that situation. So it's important to really care about historic preservation. And like I said, I tell people like make sure they preserve their family photos and like, you know, really emphasize historic preservation.
So I have another quick question before we move forward. What are the sources that you use to purchase? You mentioned eBay, but can you share with us some other sites, or like how do you build your collection?
Definitely. So a lot of times it's through eBay, because I don't feel comfortable buying portraits in estate sales, because I feel like, well, why would you like give away someone's photo? Right. So, I mean, especially if you're related to them. So like, I never like, you know, do that. Matter of fact, be honest with you, ever since I've been going to estate sales, I never had that happen to me where people have actually given away their family photos. You know how like beloved and treasured that is? That it just doesn't make any sense to do that, unless like they just don't care about someone in their family. Like, oh, this is my grandma portrait, you can have it, you know? So like a lot of these photos are anonymous because they're on eBay, and then the market is very hot right now for pictures of Black Victorians. Mm-hmm. They actually sell for way more than like their white counterparts, because they're considered more rare, like especially like you find like a Black Civil War veteran tin type or whatnot. And so me personally, like, I don't want to continue that process of like reselling. So the images that I collect and curate, and I do get them from like different auction sales and whatnot online, I want to keep them in my possession, because I consider myself like a keeper and like of these photos. Like, this is someone's loved one, and it's just like on the internet. And a lot of times, like, you have people who collect them that some people like really hold them in a very valuable, like cherishable way. And other people are just like seeing them as just like money, like, oh, this is worth hundreds, you know?
Right.
So
right.
Me personally, it's deeper to me than that. So like, that's where I get it. And I, you know, in the future, when I get older, I'm going to donate them to like Smithsonian African American Museum and like some Atlanta museums. Like,
you definitely.
Know. I'm affiliated with Apex or Apex Museum, and also Auburn Avenue Museum, you know, because honestly, I just don't feel comfortable like selling them. You know, I want to curate as many as I can, because some people like are just like, oh, I found this at a thrift store. You know, because like I've been at thrift stores and I've seen like people's pictures, and I was like, wow, that's interesting to me. Like, why that would be there, and like, do their loved ones know that this picture is there? You know, and I have this story that I want to share. The only time that I ever had one of my photos I identified was I'm friends with this lady on Facebook.
And yes, I was just about to ask you if this has ever happened to you. Okay.
No, it has. I'm friends with this lady on Facebook. And it's so crazy because I posted a picture of three women and a little girl. That photo was taken at the Auburn Avenue photography studio. And when I posted, she was like, how did you get this photo? That's my family. And she sent me like the names. And also she said she had a copy of the photo. And so she told me that someone in her family wanted to contact me. So I told them that I got the photo from eBay, because that's where I get most of my Black Americano photos. Mm-hmm. And then she told me a story that was so heartbreaking. So basically, they had a sale in California, and they hired a state liquidator. The state liquidator stole the family photos and sold it. They were only supposed to like literally help sell off certain things, but they went and they basically stole these photos while they were there. And so the estate liquidator, the estate planner, she actually resold these photos to the person I got it from on eBay. And so I was like, yes, we need to find her, because I want them to fire her and like, you know, do something. Yeah. That was horrible. And so that's why I didn't put that picture in anonymous in unsung portraits, because I didn't even feel comfortable doing that, you know? And so like, it was just like, it made me think too, like, you never know how many photos that the families don't have anymore, that, you know, these are treasure beloved photos, but something happened, you know? And also even with my family, we had gotten something stolen from us, an antique portrait of one of our ancestors. And he was riding a horse. He had a top hat on, a beautiful man. And we actually, one day my uncle saw the photo on one episode of Bill Cosby show.
Stop.
Yeah. So it makes you think a lot of these things, you know, like, where are they? Like, a lot of the photos that I have, I'm like, wow, like, where are the descendants? Because it's so many. And that's why I emphasize people preserving their family portraits. Because, you know, like I said, when it comes to the antique industry, these type of photos are very popular now. They actually cost way more. Like, a tin type of a white Victorian, you can get for like $45 on eBay. A tin type of an African American, you will pay at least like one in really bad shape, low hundreds, one in really good condition, sometimes up to thousands.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, because they're considered more rare. And so I say, like, if you have those photos, preserve them. And the family that I talked to about the people on Auburn Avenue, the one I told you about that the estate planner sold the items,
yeah.
I found out that family, you know, they knew W.E.B. Du Bois. They her husband was a professor at Clark Atlanta. He actually started, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the social work department of Clark Atlanta, I believe. It may be either sociology or social work, but he was a very esteemed professor at Clark Atlanta, and she told me the story, and I was like, wow. And I was thinking about the other photos I have, like, you never know, like, their stories too. And I was so glad that she identified it, because none of my portraits, no one has ever, like, identified. These are literally unsung portraits. And so when she told me that, I was like, wow. And it broke my heart that they actually hired an estate planner to, you know, help them with an estate sale, and she stole the photo.
Yeah,
exactly. So it was just really horrible. And it makes me think about other portraits that people get from thrift stores and whatnot and online. Like, where are the families? Because these are people's loved ones, you know, more than
I wrote that down, what you said, where are the descendants? Where are the families? And I'm hoping that this interview will inspire everybody, anybody that's interested in history and genealogy, to say, you know what, we need to protect grandma's photos that are sitting in a photo album somewhere, or they're just thinking, oh, you know, it'll be here forever. But the fact that people are stealing is just unbelievable. You reminded me of a colleague who, Cherokon and I both know her. She has books that her ancestors, her great-grandfather wrote, and it cost her, she was waiting for the price to go down and it never went down. And she paid over $1,000 for this one book.
Mm.
But she was determined. She's like, I need to have this. My great grandfather wrote this book. I'm going to pay it. But right now, even I was reminded of one of my ancestors wrote a Civil War letter to his wife. And it's at some of the letters are housed at the University of Virginia. And then one letter there was a bidding war for. So I'm sitting here going, you know, again, just what you said, where are the descendants? And then my follow-up question would be, do you know what you have? Do you know what's sitting, that history is sitting right there in front of you from either a grandmother, a grandparent, or a great-grandparent? And you're just thinking, oh, it's just their stuff. Well, their stuff is very, very important. And I hope, you know, the way you answer that question about, you know, why do you feel historic preservation is important? Because it is. And especially when it comes to our community, we have more important documents, books, pictures than we realize, and it's important to preserve them. So Tansy, in closing, what are some parting words of inspiration that you would like to share with our listeners?
Definitely. So I just want to circle back on what you said. It's so important to emphasize historic preservation. That's very important, because a lot of times in our family, there's so many treasures and heirlooms that was passed down. And if you don't want them to end up 30 years later being bidded on, you know, or like out of your possession, and you have to pay thousands of dollars to get it back, cherish it. Because a lot of people don't realize what they have in their family. Like, these ancestral photos of Black people, like I said, they're going for hundreds and thousands of dollars. Some of them are, you know, similar portraits are in museums, you know, like, especially when it comes to things like letters and books written by our ancestors during that period, that is very historical. And it's very important to preserve that. So I want people to, you know, understand that, you know, as our elders, you know, pass on and leave this up to us, it's important for us to continue that. You know, we can't leave stuff like that just up to the elders in our communities and families. Like, we all have older people in our family who are like, they preserve the family photos, you know, like my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, he has tons of photos of like my ancestors from like the 19th century and whatnot. And when he passes on, you know, in the future, you know, we are going to have to preserve those. You know, we can't, like, I feel like millennials need to really care about stuff like that, you know, and that's why I urge people in my generation and just everyone to really care about that, because I feel like a lot of times people don't realize how important that stuff is till they get older. But it's important to preserve those, and also like your community, like getting involved in the community too. Like, a lot of times when I go to some of these community meetings, it's always like older people, but younger people like are not a part of it. And sometimes they have them after work, you know, whatnot. And so it's just important to get involved in those things, you know, because preservation isn't just like the family photos, but just like the community. And then when things happen in the community and we're like, oh, you know, it's because, you know, you didn't attend the meetings, you know, you weren't trying to, you know, like, it's like, that's important. So I'm trying to encourage more millennials to like actually get more involved in preservation in some way, whether it's like your community, you know, or whether it's preserving objects, but just, you know, get involved and really care and be more community oriented. Because I feel like, I'm not saying that's dying, because when I was at the Preservation Festival, I seen a lot of people like my age that was a part of that, but I do feel like it could be more, you know, right. Like a lot of these town hall meetings and these, like, you know, a lot of times like, oh, it's older people, you know, or it's like, I'm just like, we have to care, you know, yeah. It's important. I feel like, especially with us now, like social media and everything, social media can be a good tool, you know, for things, you mm-hmm. know? And so it's important to just really like get involved with that and not just leave it up to like, you know, people in other, you know, age groups, because there's going to be a time when, you know, they pass on and we have to like carry that legacy and torch.
Exactly. Beautifully stated. We have to care. And that really is the bottom line. And, you know, like you said, encouraging younger folks to get involved. Kenzie Ward, thank you so much for joining us on Speak On It. To our listeners, you can learn more about Tansy and the very cool work she does at thenathiajewelry.com. And just a brief interjection, excuse me. The character I was referencing, I was thinking about earlier from the amazing show Lovecraft Country, was Orithia Blue. So Zenathia, Orithia, it sounded similar, but I think what's so cool about this is that in the show, she imagines her mother as Orithia Blue, and her mother actually becomes Orithia Blue at some point. And so it's kind of like in your situation, you had a vision, it came to life, and you were actually able to merge the two. So really inspiring. And I just think that's a really cool tidbit. And we want to thank our listeners for joining us. We look forward to sharing with you during our next segment of Speak On It.
Speak On It is a podcast and is immediately available to listen to at your leisure. Thank you.